Herzlich willkommen zum OMR-Podcast. Hier und heute unser Partner ENBW. Energie Baden-Württemberg heißt die Firma, ist einer der größten Stromversorger unseres Landes. Neben Strom und Gas bekommt man auch Energielösungen für Elektromobilität. Und genau davon möchte ich euch erzählen. Es gibt nämlich einen neuen Deal, der heißt ENBW Mobility Plus. Mit diesem Deal kann man komplett wechseln auf Ökostrom, und zwar zu Hause und in seinem Fahrzeug. Es gibt nämlich die Chance, einen E-Smart 40% günstiger zu leasen als normal möglich. Man bekommt Ökostrom zu Hause in einem neuen Stromtarif mit 150 Euro Sofortbonus und man bekommt 100 Euro Ladeguthaben zum Aufladen des neuen Fahrzeugs an allen Ladestationen. Dazu gibt es zum Beispiel auch eine geile App, die ENBW Mobility Plus App, zeigt alle relevanten freien Ladestationen im Umkreis und so weiter. Das Ganze ist irgendwie gut durchdacht. Schaut euch mal die Seite dazu an, enbw.com/podcast, da stehen alle Informationen. Das Angebot gilt noch bis Ende des Jahres, also denkt drüber nach, ob ihr jetzt vielleicht nochmal zum Ende des Jahres ein Zeichen setzen wollt, ganz fresh ins neue Jahr starten wollt und wirklich persönlich umsteigen wollt. Ich würde mich freuen, wäre doch vielleicht mal was, hier richtig modern und zukunftsweisend unterwegs zu sein. Viel Spaß!
Herzlich willkommen beim OMR Podcast mit Philipp Westermeier.
This week's guest, somebody very special, Mike D of the Beastie Boys. Hi, Mike.
What's up? How are you today?
Good, good.
Thank you for having me.
We're sitting here in Berlin on a Sunday late afternoon. Mm-hmm. What brings you to Berlin?
Berlin, well, what brings me here, what happened was, as a band, we've published a book. We've never done a book before.
Beastie Boys book.
Beastie Boys book, because we probably should have thought of a better title, but we didn't. So we've already disappointed you. But, yeah, so Beastie Boys book, and, yeah, Adam and I spent way too long working on the book, way too long, but we finally got it done, and now it's out, and here we are.
And you're, like, promoting it? Are you traveling across the world promoting the book?
Yeah, so we're sort of, yeah, traveling it, promoting it, you know, doing things like that. And then also we're not getting a chance to do it here in Berlin, but what we've done in New York and Los Angeles so far, and we're about to do in London, is we've sort of put together these events that kind of go around the book, that have where we present a little bit of like sort of Beastie Boys history, almost like a contextualized, almost like a museum exhibit. I mean, not as pretentious as a museum, but like a, you know, a little exhibit portion. And then we read parts of the book, and we bring work music into that a little bit with our DJ, Mixmaster Mike. So that's like a whole other or another component that we have going on as well.
So if you want, on a Beastie Boys world tour, except for it's not the Beastie Boys that we used to.
Well, it is. I mean, it is in the sense that of the history and the story that's being told. But yeah, it's not the Beastie Boys that you know in terms of us. Instead of us running around and jumping around like crazy, it's more us talking about it a little bit.
What else do you, I mean, or maybe why a book? I mean, if I look at you and if I look at today's media age, mm-hmm. wouldn't a Netflix documentary would have been the more fitting media genre to document your life and your past?
I think that's something we've talked about as well. So that I agree. I think there's going to be other layers that we can do when we do that. But for the book, I guess, you know, that the idea of it actually started quite a while ago. Like it was like Adam Yauch was still alive when we originally talked about doing a book. And it's funny because the book came out of, it was sort of the reverse way. Like Adam had this vision. He was always, as kids, he always loved the Who movie. I don't know if you know it, called The Kids Are All Right.
Yeah.
That, you know, so he was always obsessed with that movie. And we all loved it, but he was really obsessed with it. And he was like, at a certain point, he was like, you know, we need to do something like similar with us as a band, because there's so many different archival appearances from here and there and concerts and whatever, like we need to. So he's actually started to get that together. And when we were doing that, we realized, you know, there were other books that had come out about the band, but of course nothing from us, you know? So it's never, we just sort of thought, this is our chance to tell our story. So much of what happens to a band, I think what times people don't realize, is it's just the three of you or four of you in a room when so much of the history unfolds. it's not like other people are around.
But so we're still like a movie is still in play. It could be also a movie at one point.
Yeah, for sure.
And what else? I mean, you talk about the Beastie Boys a little bit as a brand, if you of the past. I mean, it's your book. It's in archives. Is that the way you see it? Is it a brand that's not active anymore?
I guess I wouldn't use the word brand. It's not, but it's. I think it's different in the sense that, or maybe it's similar, but maybe I just look at it differently in that we have this very close relationship with people that have listened to our music and buy our music and have supported what we've done for a very long time. You know, it's like, interestingly, and we never imagined it to be that way, but I think what's happened over time is that our music has, you know, that's maybe more for other people to say, not for me, but that it's like kind of this integrated part of their lives, right? You know, so in that sense, we're this thing that they always go back to. And that's what we saw with like kind of the success of the book in the US or even with these shows, you know, the people that it's like that are coming back to it are people that it's like they've had this record and this record and this record, or they've seen us play in this year and that year, and then they're happy to come back to it.
I mean, you sound so modest. I mean, in the end, you guys are legends. I mean, you are the founding fathers of what is today hip hop, maybe, right?
Well,
you
wouldn't say that, but I can say that.
I can say that. I mean, if you look at it, there's tons of like artists that are the biggest artists on the planet these days that reference you and say like, we're like following the path that you've created in the 90s, I mean the 80s, 90s, early 2000s with your music at different time. But don't you sometimes think that when you see artists that are huge these days and they like share that they got inspired by you, you feel like is that something that surprises you? I mean, you know that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm happy that a big part of the book is we're trying to explain the context, you know, the history of where we come from, right? Because we couldn't have made what we made if we weren't in New York City at this time. That was a really exciting time where it was cheap to be in New York City and you had all this different music happening from all around the world. You know, now everybody, we all have it on our phones. We can listen to any music, watch anything, see any piece of art all the time. But at that time, you had to be in New York City. New York City was a unique place, right? There wasn't, you know, London might have been cool, whatever, there's other metropolitan cities that had different cultures, but there was no other place that had all of this incredible music happening all at the same time. All these DJs, all these musicians, all these artists, all just doing their thing at the same time.
And now, I mean, you feel like when you see that some of the people that came after you, they built like businesses that they became billionaires, like the Jay-Z's and the P. Diddy's of this world. I mean, basically they are using pages from your playbook, right? Creating something different than...
Yeah, but I think it's with us, it's interesting because before you even started the interview, you were mentioning it, and what I immediately thought of is it's funny, like with us, we didn't set out to have a huge conglomerate or anything. It's actually almost the opposite because we come from a background of kind of like more of like a punk rock aesthetic. And so the cool thing with punk rock and also rap in the beginning is it was like music that no big company wanted to touch it. They didn't want anything to do with it. So you had to figure it out yourself. It wasn't a choice. You know, you had, the only option was to figure it out on your own and figure out how to make it work, whether it's making a flyer and letting people know, you know, you had to have that hustle. Whereas, and so our ambition wasn't so much to be huge. It was just to make what we loved making, but we also never had any problem with trying to let as many people as possible know what we're doing. Do you know what I mean? We weren't like, we didn't have a desire to keep it, super exclusive. It's just more that we realized like pretty early on, thankfully, after already having like a bunch of success with License Illa, it was important for the three of us to keep it about the three of us and not be, you know, and really minimize the amount of control or influence that anybody else would have. You know, we realize that autonomy, we're lucky, I think, in that way. But that also comes a little bit from punk rock. We realize like that have that autonomy. We couldn't keep doing what we were doing if we didn't have that autonomy,
isn't
right?
Isn't it funny that, like, I mean, you as the grand start of everything hip hop, everything rap, came from a completely different angle than today's like iconic figures, they are like by definition businessmen. They call themselves entrepreneurs, businessmen.
Well, I think that's what they're looking. They're presenting themselves as that, and that's what their ideal is. You know, for us, our ideal was just to be able to make stuff, to make the stuff that we love making. And then to have the business to support, not only to have the business that supports it, but also to be able to control the presentation. Like, I get some musicians, I think, don't love the visual parts of music. You know, they're more pure in terms of just working on the music side of it. And for us, we always looked at it like every chance, whether it's a record cover or a ad or making a video, it was always actually to us exciting. It wasn't a burden. It was like, oh, cool. Okay. Well, what can we do to make this our own? What can we do? That's what do we want to do in this space? This is another thing we get to do, you know, and in that way, I think the book was similar too. It's like, okay, well, how can we tell our story? So it's not just like any other book you'd read. You know, I think it was definitely, that was something that was important in our minds, was we didn't want to make a book that was, could have come from anybody else, you know, that it wasn't, and that it's not like how any other band or musician's book.
But you always, like, early on, you did things differently. I mean, you did your own label, clothing, you did fashion. You left a regular music label and started your own one. That's all the same spirit, right? Like, controlling.
Yeah, I think it's controlling. And then as you become interested in different things, you already have the foundation. Or, you know, that was, I think, one of the, it's really actually, I think, in a certain way, I mean, it comes with responsibility, but it just gives you more freedom. You know, like with Paul's Boutique, we moved to California and started making that record with the Dust Brothers. And we were spending all this money, basically wasting money on these fancy studios, you know, that are really expensive, and going there. And we realized, you know what, instead of doing that, we can build our own studio and control that. And then by building our own studio, then that gave us this creative, like, launching pad, where if we wanted to start a magazine, okay, we already had space and we were able to do that. And then we just also, I think we were very fortunate in that we had other talented people, whether it was like Spike Jones, who's shooting still photographs of us, and he just started to make videos. So he was around and he would come by the studio, you know, all the time, and we'd talk about ideas and then just start making things, start shooting photographs.
Did you just tell us Spike Jones before he was Spike Jones?
Well, he was Spike Jones, but he was more known in, like, when we started working with Spike, he was known in like the BMX, like more like the action sports world, as just a still photographer. And he'd just sort of started to do pictures, still photos of bands, you know, so he had just sort of crossed into that, but he hadn't made a music video yet.
Back to my original question. Anyway. So would you say Beastie Boys is still like an active, I mean, you said it's not a brand, but it's still like it's a label for something. Is that still like active? Would you still develop it further, or is it like maybe has it come to a certain situation and you want to keep it there?
Yeah, I actually think what's interesting is it took a while till after, like, for first, like, when Adam died, it was just so like when Yauch died, it was so sad for both Adam and I. It was a thing of we couldn't enter back into doing things creative with what was there, even though there's still obviously a lot of archive. And now it feels like we're at this place of we're really, like, doing the book was something that it felt very good, because not only were we telling the band story, but we're able to bring Adam Yauch into it, even if he's not alive, and really actually kind of for the two of us appreciate, you know, our relationship with him and present that. And then I think then doing the book, then we realized again, like I said, with these live events, then it was like we had to rewrite things and make it work for that. So now I think, like, looking at the next bit of time, there's a bunch of different projects that are going to happen over time, whether they're reissues of records or things that we haven't released. But then also, I think you're right, you know, I think we're part of what we're doing is trying to figure out what's going to be the best filmed way to present it, because there's just a lot of stories and a lot of elements there that can be told very creatively.
What else do you do these days? I mean, people that follow you, did they know you have like a radio show, a podcast show on Apple? You do collaborations here and there. I mean, you work with Mercedes, AMG, you I think you, I saw that you did a bag partnership with Herschel, stuff like that. So like smaller things here and there.
Yeah.
Is that something that I'm missing? What else is are you doing these days?
No, well, there's a bunch. So, I mean, I think that how all these things tie in is it's kind of like the same as what I said when we are really active all the time as a band, we'd have whatever, there's a record cover, a music video, ad, whatever. And so I think now it's been exciting, like with the book coming out. You know, we did this, it was actually for it was an anniversary of the Hello Nasty album. So we did a record bag with Herschel. For the book, actually, we did a capsule collection with a brand called Fact, F-A-C-T, which is a US-based kind of, that's really at like the core of kind of like raw creative skateboarding. Like it's a more underground company. So we did a capsule with them of all stuff that was just inspired, images that were inspired from and by the book. And so, you know, just having that opportunity to try things that are new to us but still fit into what we're doing. And I think then, you know, with the partnership with AMG, for me it's a really fun space because they kind of the AMG cars are just about high performance. So of course, yeah, do I love driving the cars? Yeah, but what's cool about the things that I've done with them is that they're allowing to have the space, whether it's putting on a museum show or making something else, of just being creative, you know, and they're not looking to make something that's like fits their ad. They realize, okay, we're in business with them so that they can make something cool.
Kurze Unterbrechung und Hinweis auf Salzen, eine Rucksackmarke aus dem Hause FontOff. Wer zuletzt bei uns viel zugehört hat, der hat FontOff Gründer Sven Oliver Pink hier im Podcast kennengelernt. Eine Wahnsinnsgründergeschichte. Verschiedene Brands im Rucksackbereich. Die Business Rucksack Brand, die nun wirklich richtig cool ist, ist Salzen. Ich selber trage einen Rucksack aus diesem Hause. Kann sagen, das macht eine Menge Sinn. Für mich persönlich, weil ich es ganz schön aussehen finde, aber es gibt auch noch ein paar andere Argumente. Es gibt zum Beispiel flache, flexible Schulter Gurte, einen einzigartigen Tragekomfort, ein auffällig minimalistisches Design und so weiter und so weiter. Am Ende schaut euch einfach mal an, was es da genau gibt. Salzen.com/OMR kann man sich die Rucksäcke einfach alle angucken und mit dem Code OMR20 kann man beim Checkout 20% bekommen auf euer neues Business Backpack. Kurzer Hinweis noch vielleicht auf das neueste Modell, den Iconic Notch. Das ist sozusagen das, was ich gerade ausgedacht habe. Ich finde Salzen insbesondere deswegen auch interessant, weil ich weiß, dass die Gründer mit extremer Leidenschaft und sehr, sehr viel Liebe zum Detail an den Produkten rumentwickeln. Ja, und so habe ich halt gerne so ein Ding dabei. Vielleicht ihr ja auch. Viel Spaß.
But you're not afraid to like be close to brands. I mean, it's not that important to you to like keep a boundary between the Beastie Boys and your work and brands. I mean, obviously you're like...
Well, I think we're careful about it. You know, and we also have to protect our name because unfortunately there's other brands that seem to like to use our stuff without making the partnership, but I think we're careful about it because you have to find things that fit and not do the things that don't fit.
But if you look
but
at,
but we're like, not. It's not like okay, we won't. Yeah, I guess we're not afraid of it because it's for us. Like if it's an opportunity to do something new that we're almost a little bit uncomfortable with, but it's still staying genuine to us making it, then we're very open to that.
In hindsight, would you say that you were here and there maybe even too careful with the Beastie Boys brand? I mean, you could have done so much more. If you look at what Kanye is doing these days and what all these big name rappers are doing, they're like commercial as hell, and nobody seems to care.
Right. Well, I think it's also a different time though now. You know, we cared because of what we came from, because we came from this very punk rock, very artistic background in New York City where to be honest, those opportunities didn't even really exist. You know, like the big commercial brands, hip hop was underground music, rap music was underground music, punk, dance were all underground music. So it wasn't like big companies wanted to, or brands wanted to work with that. You know, you didn't even have that opportunity. So it is a different time now. And I think people, you know, yeah, it's just seen differently.
The first street style fashion label that I noticed that came also out of your sort of ecosystem was XLarge. Are you still involved with XLarge?
Yeah, well, we sold it, but I am not involved, but that was a lot of fun. But yeah, when we started with Adam and Eli, who are my partners, and it was a very exciting time in LA because it was a time where You know, it was interesting because I think that was the beginning of streetwear in the sense that, like for Adam, Eli, and myself, like with XLarge, when we started it, the idea was, okay, there's certain brands that we like to buy, whether it's like Carhartt or Ben Davis, but we were like, well, what if we, there are things that we wanted to change in each thing, you know, so how do we start doing it? And it was the same as starting a record label or anything else where you don't know what you're doing. You know, we just sort of figured it out as we went. And I think that's what a lot of, like at that time in LA, it was actually in the early 90s, it was an exciting time for what kind of became the beginning of like streetwear, basically.
Me being,
you know, and now it's this huge business.
I know.
But, you know, when we started, it was really just about the expression. And then it worked out well financially in the end, but it was, you know, it was really about just having that. I mean,
if you look at what's going on these days, I mean, me being the marketing guy, everybody in marketing talks about Supreme. I mean,
yeah, of course.
And what they did, I mean, and now they're partnering.
But I feel like Supreme comes from that same time.
Exactly.
And that same thing. And they were, you know, still like, even if you look at the new Supreme film, I don't know if you went to like the premiere in Paris or whatever, but like they're able to stay true somehow to core skateboarding.
Do you feel like that?
Well, I mean, as a brand, it's obviously huge. Like when people are waiting online to buy what they buy, I don't think that doesn't have to do with core skateboarding. But somehow as like a brand with the skate side of it, yeah, like with the new film, they still, like they're making the right film with the right kids in it. You know, it's pretty interesting.
You talk to James Jebbia once in a while?
Yeah, I haven't seen him in a while, though.
But I mean, you know...
I know him from New York, from... You know, from like that time that I'm talking about, like the early '90s time, and yeah, I mean, he's a good example, right? He started it. You know, it was like teeny. It was such a small store, and he had, you know, Union, and you know, first he was partners with Sean Stussy with Stussy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And now he has that huge label that seems to like be taking over the world.
Well, it's funny. It's a huge label, and not only that, it's like it's interesting now to see how that's, to me, how that influences mainstream fashion.
Exactly.
You know, now you have like a big company, like, you know, I was really like Louis Vuitton. Now there's like, they hire Virgil to be their creative director. And then Virgil, when he does his first men's collection, he releases it like Supreme. You know, it's, he just does a drop.
I know,
which is something that doesn't happen in
high fashion.
In high fashion, ready to wear, whatever.
But I would assume all these labels, they're also chasing you. I mean, who's more like the core of this scene and the core of this whole thing than you guys? I mean, like, I feel like Beastie Boys, that's in everything, in Supreme and in XLarge and in all these, in Stussy, all these brands. Is that not like brands approaching you and wanting you to like partner and then taking on the Beastie Boys brand and putting them on other brands and doing partnerships?
Mm-hmm. I think the franchise, we're open. We're ready for offers.
Okay. You'll get them. When you see that, like the relevance of hip hop and this whole thing has to, in today's world. I mean, I know that you didn't see that coming, and you just said that you didn't see that coming, and it wasn't like you weren't aware at the time. But you look at it now, and like, let's assume you were very influential for that. Do you wish you'd have done things differently, so maybe they would have, they came out different than today? So you, I mean, are you critical of what's happening today?
No, I mean, I actually feel pretty proud of what we did. It's just, I think it's kind of what I said earlier. There's different opportunities now than there were 20 years ago, you know? And so...
Do you care about this whole...
I think, yeah. Well, anyway, yeah, like if you came to... like, it, I think what we try to get across in the book or in the performance that we're doing in London later in the week is, yeah, we are actually really grateful for all these different opportunities that we got to... of all these different ways we got to present what we were interested in doing. And no, yeah, and if now, 2018, it would be different because the landscape is totally different. The opportunities are different. And like you said, you know, we spent our lives of like doing, traveling the world and going to places where people are like, oh, okay, well, when's hip-hop going to end? When are people going to be tired of rap music, basically? You know, I feel like that existed for so long in the curve, and then now we're at this completely other place where rap music is the pop music.
Exactly. When did it switch? When was the moment that it switched?
I think it's gradual. I think it started, you know, I think, but I'm trying to think. I feel like in terms of rap music being accepted as a dominant pop music wasn't until really the end of the 90s, early 2000s, was really when, like, in terms of commercial force, I felt that then, you know, big companies, brands, whatever, just in terms of the public consciousness of how rap music was looked at, then it finally shifted to being, okay, accepted part of the mainstream.
Do you still follow it closely? I mean, would you know, like, up-and-coming stuff?
Yeah, no, I mean, I definitely, like, there's stuff. I mean, I'm not like, up on every SoundCloud rapper. but in terms of new record, I mean, that's actually one of the reasons I really love doing my radio show or podcast that I do with Apple Music, is that it kind of it forces me to, because I don't want to just play. There's old things that are new to me, but I'm interested in playing things that are new to me, whether it's new things or old things that I didn't know. And so by doing the radio show, it's kind of great because it forces me to kind of keep mining through and trying to find what I like out of what's out there.
How big is the radio show?
Big time. Okay. No, I feel like I've been really lucky because I just feel like I've been really happy with it. I have so many guests that have come on that I really love. You know, the format of it is we use it, music is the foundation, and so we're kind of like playing songs back and forth that end up in a way being a way that people are able to explain themselves or talk or give a little bit of insight into their story because it's their relationship with different songs in their lives. You know,
do you sometimes think that, damn, why don't I do live music anymore? I mean, you look at the Rolling Stones, they're like, I don't know how old they are, but they're like still on stage. They travel the world as a band, and you feel like that's missing. Is that something that you wish you still had?
Life. I mean, it was a lot of fun and something we did for decades. We spent so much of our lives touring, and so yeah, it's interesting now that's like the main. That's basically how you monetize what you do if you're a musician now, which is different in a way. I mean, we did it for years, but that it's different and has a different importance now. I don't know. It's a hard call because, like, you know, I'm sure if Yauk were alive, we probably would still be in that position of trying to figure out if we were still having fun doing it. You know, we would be coming back together and doing it every once in a while. But I think on the other hand, with like what Adam and I are doing with having done the book and the other things we have coming up, it's like we actually get to do stuff that represents the band and it is coming from the band, but is like in a place that we're not comfortable with yet. You know, that's in a new place, and that's actually to us always the more exciting place, is to actually try and do something that is new to us.
I saw a video of you at a huge festival, I think. It's on YouTube, and you were like there as sort of MC and be on stage, and then once in a while you're like still singing and still like really like taking on the stage, and it looked like you still have fun doing that.
Yeah, no, definitely. Like this last summer, I was at Primavera in Barcelona or other festivals, and you know, it's nice that's also kind of it ties in with both what I'm doing with the radio show and then also our history. If I can DJ and play records that I love, but then, you know, sometimes I just can't help myself. I gotta grab the microphone a little bit.
Anybody there in rap music that you particularly like? I mean, that you think could be the game changer if that you guys were like 10, 20, 30 years ago? That you think,
I mean,
that guy's different? That guy or this I don't know. People have like a different spirit than just a very good rapper.
Right.
More than that.
I don't know. It's hard to say. I don't know in terms of becoming like a cultural force. I think there's different, like I like Danny Brown's voice, like in terms of like an underground person. I like Travis Scott's voice in terms of like a much more pop mainstream rapper. I like Kid Cudi for his emo pop songwriting. But you know, there's different people I like. I don't know if any of them, you know, there's so many different people. I like Vince Staples just because he's very creative and focused. I'm trying to think who's, you know, actually, I would say like who does a good job of just bringing all the elements together is I have to give Tyler props. Tyler, the creator, because they did the thing with Odd Future where it was kind of like a Wu-Tang Clan model of having this big group that included all these different talented artists. And then that just became the launching pad for whether it was Frank Ocean or Tyler or Earl Sweatshirt or whatever. And then Tyler really took that lane and, you know, really went with it and does the clothing line. And, you know, and he's just very on top of it, I think, with his visuals and the music.
And anybody that you think rap is your passion, it's your life in the end. Is there people that you look at and you're afraid they're selling out? I mean, it's they're like overdoing it?
No, I mean, I think, I don't think it's for me to say. You know, I think to me, there's always that element, like pop music is popular music. So, and then there's stuff that sort of accidentally like ends up going into that place. And I feel like Beastie Boys are part of that. We didn't plan on ending up in this popular place, but it crossed over into there. And that happens a lot with rap music. And there's probably other people who really want to make hit records more and are really good at that. You know, and that's, you always have that. I think in whatever kind of music, you have those two things coexisting.
So you're not afraid?
No. Because I'm not afraid. I guess, you know, as a band, in terms of how we managed what we did, the idea was being loving what we were doing, which I think that made it authentic by loving what we were doing. But it wasn't about holding back. If there was opportunities, we'd take those opportunities. If there's an open look, we're taking the open look.
Okay. You used to be very political as a band and as people. You still are? I mean, are you still like involved like that?
Yeah, I think with the band, it was something that just in terms of growing up as people or evolving, we got to see that our voices did matter or could influence people. So it just seemed weird not to use that. So, you know, then it's like, you know, we didn't start being in a band so we could be on an awards show. But then if you're on the awards show and you realize you have the opportunity to talk about something and be clear about it, it would seem like a shame to waste that and not take advantage of it.
But I mean, being influential doesn't seem to be that important to you. I mean, if I look at your social profiles, like Facebook, Instagram, and that, you don't care about that game too much, do you?
Well, I think we like the aspect of like communicating directly with people, because that's what I feel like we always did. It was just a lot more inefficient in the 90s when we started doing it, because you didn't. Now you've got these direct to people outlets that everybody's using. But at the time, and that's really one of the reasons we started Grand Royal, which was our record label and magazine and everything, was really just to kind of interact and communicate, to be able to put out what we want when we want and communicate with the people that were interested, you know, that were the audience for that in a direct way, and not having to rely on another company or other companies to do that for us.
Right, but one would imagine that you're still like really like active on these platforms, really like taking advantage of today's opportunities, but you seem to be like a little quiet or not so active.
Yeah, I think, well, we're not children. No, but we're, you know, I don't feel like we need to add more noise to the world. It's more like we want to focus on making what we're making and then use those platforms to sort of play around with a little bit in terms of getting that out there.
But it's not a strategy. I mean, limitation and being very exclusive. I mean, today in fashion, as we said with Supreme and these drops and everything, it's a strategy to like, you know, limit something and make it more, I don't know, sought after. Mm-hmm. But it's not an active strategy that you say, like, look, we are more quiet. We're not out there like everybody else is on these platforms to stand out a little more.
I don't know. We didn't think about it that way. Honestly, I think we're more, it's just that we want to focus on our time on making what we're going to make, not on talking about what we're making. And so it's a little different.
Ganz kurzer, dringender Aufruf. Hört mal wieder einen Podcast, am besten den von Facebook. Die Kollegen von Facebook machen das Facebook Marketing Update und haben dort immer den Jin Choi als Host, ein Facebook-Manager hier aus Deutschland. Sehr guter Mann. Und der lädt sich immer externe und interne Experten zum Thema Facebook-Marketing ein. Und manchmal geht es auch mehr um Marketing als um Facebook. Diese Woche oder in dieser aktuellen Folge sind die externen Experten keine geringeren als Dr. Florian Heinemann, Investor, Marketing, Vordenker aus Berlin, Florian Heinemann, den man hier aus dem Podcast und aus anderen Podcasts dieser Welt auch kennt. Und ich selber durfte tatsächlich auch dabei sein. Und wir haben uns sehr interessant, wie ich finde, unterhalten. Ich habe da versucht, mein Bestes zu geben. Heinemann natürlich viel, viel besser. Aber am Ende ist, glaube ich, noch trotzdem eine Folge, die man sich gut anhören kann. Es geht um Marketing bei Facebook und Marketing insgesamt. Ein ganz großer Blick auf die Branche. Das Facebook-Marketing-Update gibt es überall da, wo es Podcasts gibt. Insbesondere aber unter fb.me/das-Marketing-Update.
And you sometimes here and there you're like involved with music. I saw that you did something with Portugal the Man, for instance.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Is that still like a big side of your life, like helping others produce music?
Yeah, I mean, I like that, again, in terms of opportunities, that I like being able to produce bands when I feel like I can help them refine what they're doing and help them, you know, make something better than they would have made if I wasn't involved. Like, I guess that's kind of the lens I look at it. Like, when I'm approached by a band to work with them, is like, well, can I really make this something that I think is going to be better? Can I make a better record with them than if they just went in with an engineer or whatever?
Did you get approached a lot?
So I do get approached on some things. I just I have to be kind of choosy because I just don't have that much time. You know, it'd be different if I was just around sitting around making that could produce records with people all the time. But you know, I have limited time, so I have to try to make it count.
And Portugal the Man was the biggest one, or did I miss something?
Yeah. It was good because the record did really well for them.
Yeah.
And plus, you know, I just really like those guys. I was a fan of I started working with them just really from being in a place of I really liked the record before that, the one they did with Danger Mouse, and I was just kind of a fan of theirs. So, and I was lucky in terms of they turned out to be very nice people.
So you contacted them?
No, I had done a remix for them on the album before the one I worked on, and then they really liked it, and so I met them through that, and they happened to be in New York, and that's when we still had our studio in New York. So they're like, oh, we really like the remix. Could we try? We have a bunch of different ideas. Could we maybe try making something? So we just sort of started working. It wasn't even really a plan. Like, we just sort of started, okay, cool. Let's come in tomorrow. Let's see. Let's try and put some things together.
Yeah. I mean, they must be lucky that you're doing that.
So, yeah, it was cool. It worked out well.
What's your definition of success these days? And what do you consider a success? I mean, is it just being happy, or do anything commercially, or anything that you still have in mind?
I guess that's, for me, it's about being able to make things in areas that are like a little bit new to us, but then still be able to do it at a work, be able to work really hard on those things and do them at a high level. You know, I don't think we're interested. We're not really interested in, okay, if we're going to do a documentary, we don't want to just hand that off to somebody and be like, oh, it's okay. Adam and I are both really want to keep this very high level of involvement, which means that we have to work a lot more hour. You know, it's not, there's a lot of time that it's not fun.
So if you do
it's
a book, fun you do doing it. It. And if you do a
right,
film, you
do
really
it.
Do
exactly.
It.
Yeah. And with the book, we did that. And then with these events or live shows that we're doing, we really did, you know, we had to put in all those hours of rewriting stuff and figuring out what works and what doesn't work.
How big are the locations that you're like doing the live shows in?
They're all like theaters, like between like 1,500 and 3,000 seat, like beautiful, like all in. It seems to work best in these old, like beautiful old theaters. I think part of that is because as a band, we were never able to play those places because they were too nice.
You couldn't destroy them.
No, because people have to be able to jump around. Yeah, you couldn't. Yeah, exactly. They get damaged too easily.
Okay. And it, but it was, I mean, you're not thinking it from, at no time were you thinking about it, obviously, from a commercial angle. I mean, one would think, well, these theaters are too small, only like 2,000 people. That doesn't make sense. We are the Beastie Boys. We should fill like a stadium. You don't look at things like that.
I think we figured out that it just feels right. What we're doing. It's more important than, yeah, the shows sell out and they sell out quickly, but what we're doing feels right in those rooms. So that has to be the priority, or at least for us, that's the priority. It's making something that really works and is really good instead of compromising that to, sure, you could compromise that and it'd be easier to make money, but then you're compromising.
So that's something that's with you all these years, not compromising.
I think as much about, I mean, well, obviously there's times you do have to compromise, whatever.
What was the biggest compromise you did?
But, I don't think there's like a single big one. It's just maybe we didn't. Maybe it's just that we looked at it as more like there were opportunities and we were happy to take those opportunities, you know. But I guess compromise is like, as a band, we like playing to bigger audiences. We didn't feel like that was a compromise. It was more a matter of like, you look at that as, well, how do you make it work so that it's not like we're little ants and we're far away from the, you know, it was always about trying to do different things that make it more interesting and make it work for what it is.
Anything that you wish you'd had at your heyday, peak Beastie Boys times from today's age, like social media platforms, obviously would have been nice to have them at the time, right?
Yeah, I think like, you know, like say print, you know, doing print is a pain in the ass. That's why people don't. That's why print media has died. There's a reason for it, because it's, you know, I know people are like, oh, why is he? You know, but the reason I say that is it's you're having to spend a lot of effort to make something that in most cases doesn't last that long. And so the fact that now you can do that and you don't have to deal with the distribution, and your distribution isn't a physical thing anymore, and you're not having to even deal with the selling ads, whatever, you know, it all, everything is kind of streamlined that way. So you can really just have it be about what your expression is, what you're talking about, what you want to discuss, and have it be that, you know, that would have made our lives a lot easier.
Yeah. And I feel like,
that's how it is. You know, we didn't, that technology, it didn't exist. Those platforms didn't exist. The technology didn't exist. The means to do it did not exist. There weren't that many people who had access online. Nobody had smartphones, you know.
But I feel like you'd been the perfect band for an Instagram account, for an Instagram age. I mean, you'd probably be so creative with that platform and with that direct-to-consumer connection. And it's so sad that you're not in that, right, in that area.
Yeah, no, it's true. All right, we missed that one.
Any other opportunities that you wish you'd have taken in the, looking back?
I mean, of course, there's collaborations, because there's so many people. I feel like, things that didn't quite happen. Like, you know, we were supposed to do something with Andre 3000 from Outkast, and then we never finished that, or something with MIA that we did but never got finished, or, you know, things like, which I guess we could still finish both those things, but you know what I mean? Things that didn't quite get finished. Those are kind of the things that I guess, you know, I would like wish that we could have, those we worked on, they were like there, never got all the way there.
Okay, maybe last question, what's your connection to Germany? I mean, you're coming here to Berlin, but you're not performing in Berlin, right?
No, we're not doing the show.
So Mercedes,
here,
obviously, is some kind of connection, but anything, I mean, the fans that you have here, obviously, a connection, but...
Well, and just also the book, I think, you know, is important to, remember, this is a place where I think there's an audience for the book, and
yeah, there's tons of Beastie Boys fans here. Yeah, they want to see
you. Talk about it, right? So
you should come up with something. I mean, people want to see you.
Oh, we can come back and do the show.
Yeah. Who do I have to talk to?
Yeah.
I mean, I know that you're like came always from the political left side. I mean, you're like punk roots, and now things are going in a completely different direction in the US, especially. I mean, and you are still perceived as so true and so honest as the icons that you are. Don't you like sometimes feel the urge to like do something and speak out and take a position? And
yeah, definitely. It's frustrating. I mean, I think for Adam and myself, like we never would have imagined. You know, we looked at it like things like our whole lives from being kids to adults, that it was always this progression of people as people being that we'd get more progressive, right? And we would have better education, better opportunities for people, and really being able to like treat all people truly as equals, and really having equal opportunity for everybody. And it's crazy that to see some of those things, you know, I think there's two directions at it, right? There's part of, in certain ways, you have like all the stuff where it seems like, oh, we're going backwards on the environment. We're going backwards in terms of actually being able to have opportunity for everybody equally. And now it's more about opportunity only for a very small, wealthy percentage of the population. But I also think then there's like kind of like the underground, the punk rock reaction to that stuff at the same time, where I think you're going to have great strides in terms of, you know, true equality for women, true just equality for everyone. But I don't think Adam or I would have foreseen, you know, we always saw it as sort of like progressing and never would have seen it taking two steps backwards, which it definitely has.
And then you feel like you want to be involved, and you want to like, I don't know, like use your recognition and then your reach. And then is that something that you think about at all? Like, or maybe your influence? I mean, if I see
a little bit, I'm careful, because I want to be, you know, I have to be realistic about who I am as a human, and I'm flawed. You know, I'm a flawed human, just like everybody is. And then I also, at the same time, what are my qualifications, right? You know, so but at the same time, we also do really have heartfelt opinions about stuff. And so when things are really coming out of balance. I think it is important for us to use our platform we get to be able to do creative things and say things.
I mean, and the one thing that you have is, I think, is trust. I mean, since the Beastie Boys is such a, I mean, you never really sold out. I mean, I think especially, I mean, at least here in Germany, the perception is still like a very true and real band that never like overdid it. And that, I mean, people, I think, trust that you are true to your ideals or to your roots. And that's something that's valuable, I think, that you could leverage with the message.
But, all right. Well, thank you.
I don't know. That's just my feeling. And I was wondering if you feel like the urge of I don't know, just getting involved and I mean, I see like how people look up to you. I saw you on Jimmy Fallon on the show when you I don't know, what was that, a couple of months ago when you won the Jimmy Fallon?
Yeah, no, not even. I was like a few weeks ago. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, Jimmy Fallon seems to be your biggest fan. I mean, that's what he said, and he says it to a lot of people. But it was like you could feel it that there's so many people like that influence the world today, and they are like looking back and then like got influenced themselves by what you did. And so I think there's power. There's, you have a lot of leverage, and then a lot of people trust what you do and what you did. And so I think you should use that. I don't know. Just right. closing statement, okay. from my side.
Closing, yeah.
Okay. So maybe we'll see you again in Germany at some point.
Yeah, for sure.
For music or for book reading.
Music
or for a show.
Book reading or a show or
a free movie maybe at some
who
point.
Who knows? We don't know what it is. Yeah. Film premiere.
Okay, and you're open
big,
for business.
Big premiere.
And
yeah.
You're open for, if the right brand comes along, you're open.
Right.
Okay, thank you very much for doing this.
All right,
thank
cool.
you.
Thank you guys.
Übrigens, bevor alles vorbei ist, noch ein Hinweis. Wir haben einen ganzen eigenen OMR-Podcast mit englischen Gesprächen. Der steht hier nicht so im Vordergrund, den werdet ihr vielleicht gar nicht kennen. Deswegen nochmal der Hinweis. Unter OMR-Podcast und nicht OMR-Podcast-Channel, das ist nämlich das, was ihr jetzt hier hört. Der OMR-Podcast ist explizit auf Englisch, englische Gespräche, die hier noch nicht aufgetaucht sind. Das häufig habe ich das Gespräch geführt, ab und zu meine Kollegin Heidi, die Amerikanerin ist, hier bei uns arbeitet. Und wir hatten da Top-Besucher oder Gäste in den letzten Wochen und Monaten von 9gag Gründer Ray Chen oder Reddit-Gründer Alexis Ohanian, viele, viele andere. Hört mal rein und guckt mal, unter dem OMR-Podcast gibt es englische Gespräche mit internationalen Stars des Marketings. Viel Spaß!